Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. If you're a senior and not looking to downsize your home now that you've retired, you're in pretty good company. Many seniors want to stay in their current home and live there for as long as possible. Jason Heath from Objective Financial Partners is going to join us to talk about how the change in assumptions can affect your financial plan. Then, are you in debt? Maybe a consumer proposal is what you have pursued. Maybe it's time to get out of it early. Grim Nanji is the CEO of Marble Financial, and he's going to tell us why he holds the view that a proposal might not be the best option, and getting out of it early could be a way forward. Now, not everyone has a pension plan. That's the understatement of the year. But there is a particular group that has never had this kind of option available to them on a broad scale, and that is physicians, doctors. Blue Peer has launched Canada's first pension plan for doctors. And we will talk to the company's founder and CEO, James Pierlo, about their initiative on that front. Plus, new research from BE Works in collaboration with the Ontario Securities Commission on protecting aging investors by using behavioral insights. Our blogger spotlight is Tori Dunlap from her first 100K. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. It is very challenging to begin your financial journey when you don't know where to start. It's tough. Many people have probably checked out a personal finance blog at some point or another seeking advice. On this show, we really love to put our spotlight on some of the websites and blogs out there, different voices, different perspectives. And today we're focusing on one called Her First 100K. Tori Dunlap is the creator of Her First 100K, and she joins us now from Seattle, Washington. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me. It is a rainy day in Seattle, but, you know, wouldn't have
it any other way.
This
just in, big surprise, rainy day in Seattle. Oh, my goodness. The thing that struck me about your writing is the tone. So I'm going to quote a couple things. The very act of a woman getting her financial S together is feminist. Managing money is a challenge. Since when have you been afraid of a challenge? What tone are you going for here?
Yeah, I think to prove your point, when I was starting my personal finance journey, I got so much conflicting information and I was trying to figure out someone I could trust and someone who understood my own experience. And I graduated college in 2016 and kind of came to adulthood in a very different America than I was planning on, and realized that a financial education is our best form of protest as women, and that we have to start having conversations about money that are also conversations about politics and systemic oppression and all of these different issues. And so I started Her First 100K after my own goal of saving $100,000 at age 25, after I achieved that goal, and built this financial speaking and coaching business and financial guidance around this concept that, you know, a financial education and fighting the patriarchy is the best, it's the best way we can start building wealth and also start having impact, or a bigger impact on our communities as well.
You use the phrase fight the patriarchy a number of times. What does that mean to you?
Sure. I mean, that's a whole, you know, couple hours of conversation, probably a couple days. But for me, I hear these statistics all the time, and we probably know them. You know, women make 78 cents to a man's dollar. It's even worse if you're a woman of color. We invest later compared to men. We either don't invest our money at all, or we wait to invest, thus losing the amount of money that we could be making on returns. And then actually women live 7 years longer on average than men. So we have to manage our money differently. All of these different factors make it so obvious that we have to manage our money and invest our money and negotiate differently. And so these are the conversations I want to have, not just how to better your money, but also things that are more focused on this larger issue.
Yeah, we on this program, we talk a lot about the gender dynamics in finance and in personal finance in particular, partly informed by the fact that I'm the parent of a 10-year-old girl. And we need to start the work now so she will grow up into a world in which those statistics aren't quite so ridiculous as they are today.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about your journey. You referenced the fact that you had saved $100,000 at 25 years old. How did you do it? And are you still a member of that organized crime syndicate?
I'm the queen of the organized crime.
Oh, perfect.
Syndicate.
Of course, that's called the fighting the patriarchy within the organized crime families.
So I am the first to acknowledge that, a privilege is part of my story. I was able to graduate debt-free from college, not just because I had, parents who were able to financially support me a little bit, but also because I worked 3 jobs while I was in school, got tens of thousands of dollars of merit scholarships. But I'm the first to acknowledge that the 100K at 25 goal would have been way slower, or it wouldn't have happened as quickly if I had student loans. So that was a part of it. The other pieces are I started investing really early. I opened up a Roth IRA when I was 21. And so was able to, kind of reap the rewards of that and of, a continued market growth, as well as continuing to invest even more of my salary. I also side hustled. So Her First 100K, which is now my full-time business, actually started as a side hustle 4 years ago. So I had a 9-to-5 in marketing where I was able to save about 27% of my take-home pay. And then I was also saving all the money I made from Her First 100K. So there are a lot of different aspects to hitting that 100K goal. And the coolest part was being able to found Her First 100K and have this community of other women who were not only cheering me on, but able to follow my journey and learn from it as well. And we've kind of started this global movement now of people starting, growing, trying to hit that Her First 100K goal, whatever that looks like.
You write about a budgeting method that, quote, doesn't make me want to die. That is a very compelling yeah. marketing promise. I think you went back to your corporate marketing playbook to find that. What is the essence of your budgeting method that puts the cyanide in the trash can?
Yeah, I talk about it a lot in my Back to Basics course, which is the safer course that I have. But really what it comes down to is value-based spending. I'm never going to tell you can't buy something. I think that's restrictive. I don't think that's helpful. And I also don't believe in tracking every single penny because I want you to be able to live your life. I want you to be able to to save money and to also spend money on things that are important to you. And really, the TLDR, the too long didn't read of the Back to Basics budgeting method, is making sure you automate your savings. And so if you're listening, I'm sure you've talked about this before, but one of the easiest things you can do to better your financial life is to set up an automatic transfer from your checking account into your savings account. So it's on autopilot and you don't even have to think about it. And that's kind of the start of that budgeting method, is if you pay yourself first, the rest of it can fall into place.
You do not like the phrase empowering women. Why do you not like that phrase?
Thank you so much for asking the question, because I wish we talked about it more. So I understand the intent behind it, and it's great. It's raising up women, advocating for them. But the definition of the word empower is to be given power. I don't need to be given power. No woman needs to be given power. We already have power. We just need to know how to use it. So I don't use empowering women in my marketing. I don't use that phrase to talk about what I do, because I don't need to give another woman power. No one needs to give me power. I have power. I just need the tools and the resources and the knowledge to be able to harness that power in order to build the life I want.
It's fantastic. If you, and you do have a platform, you do have a voice, most of the CEOs of North America's big banks and credit unions to a lesser extent, but big banks are men. Most of them are white men. If they were listening to this conversation, what would be your call to action for them? What would be your request? What would you say they need to do in service of your mission?
I mean, there's so many things. And as soon as you say, Fortune 500 CEOs, I think about the statistic that there's more CEOs named John are women.
It just
crazy. So there's so many different solutions. There's so many different ways that we can support women in the workplace and advocate for them, and not just white women, but women of color as well. But I would say the biggest thing that CEOs in leadership can do, especially if you're a man in leadership, is give women the tools to succeed and make them really concrete. I remember speaking at an event last year, and it was actually a whole women's empowerment event. But then I discovered that the company who was running it and who was sponsoring it didn't offer paid family leave and didn't offer spaces for either pregnant women or women who were nursing to be able to, to nurse, to pump, to have a safe space in order to do that. So just as simple as make sure you're taking care of your female employees. Make sure that they are offered paid family leave, lactation rooms. Make sure that they're offered the same pay as their male counterparts. And if we start there, everything can start to change, right? If we give women these very, very, crazy, novel solutions in terms of, you know, making sure that they feel welcomed and valued, they're really not that hard. It's really not hard to make sure that you are creating a workplace that feels friendly and feels, compassionate towards women. So I would say that one of the easiest ways to start, you know, making sure that you are uplifting women and advocating for them is starting at your own company.
That's great. Clearly, yours is much more than a traditional personal finance blog. Tori, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great conversation.
Tori Dunlap is the author, the blogger, the force behind her first 100K. Check it out. She joined us today from Seattle, Washington.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There has been a huge increase in the value of real estate in most parts of this country in the last decade. And that has made the home a pretty significant part of many people's net worth, certainly those who own homes. Sometimes that is at the expense of retirement savings. So people rationalize it by saying, oh, well, I'll just downsize later. I'll downsize in retirement. Really? Really? Well, according to our next guest, seniors are no longer moving in droves. They're just not necessarily downsizing in the way that everyone thought that they would. So what does that mean for their financial plan? What does that mean for the housing market? Joining us now to talk about this retirement downsizing myth, his phrase, is Jason Heath, certified financial planner at Objective Financial Partners. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. How you doing?
What does the data say about downsizing? Are seniors staying put? Are they saying, I'm not leaving this house until you carry me out in a wooden box?
To a certain extent. And I'll tell you what, I've been working with clients planning retirement for 20 years, and I write a lot of articles, and it crossed my mind that, you know, of all the people that I've worked with who planned to downsize, the number of people who actually downsize seems much smaller than those who plan it. So that's what got me digging into the research a little bit. And there was a good study that Ryerson's National Institute on Aging did back in the summer. And they asked people, I believe it was seniors over the age of 55, questions about living in their home and downsizing. And they found that 91% of people said they'd like to live safely and independently in their own home as long as possible. This was done pre-COVID, so there may be a little bit of a COVID impact on people's opinions of retirement and nursing homes, but certainly most people want to stay in their homes, according to that study.
Yeah, and certainly, my parents are in their 80s. I am not super interested in having them move to a retirement living, like a group arrangement of any sort,
right,
in the situation that we're in now.
Yeah.
There are many implications. Let's start off by talking about the housing market, in particular in major centers where condos have become a more significant part of the housing mix. How mm-hmm. do seniors compare the cost of their, you know, suburban 3 or 4 bedroom home with the cost of moving to a tower or a townhome?
Sure. Well, I think there's a few different things at play. I know that anecdotally from you know, speaking to people, a lot of people say, geez, if I move from a house into a condo, I may not actually come out of it with money. I may be swapping dollars for dollars and may not come out ahead. And there was a Royal LePage report recently that found that the median price per square foot in Montreal, Ottawa, Greater Vancouver, Greater Toronto, so a number of different places across the country, condo prices per square foot were significantly higher than that of single family dwellings. And in Toronto, for example, the median price per square foot for a condo was about 53% higher than per square foot of single family dwellings. So, you know, the data seems to support that selling a house, moving into a condo doesn't necessarily mean you come out of it with money. And I've found a lot of people are very hesitant to pay condo fees as well. So there's a few different deterrents, I think, from people actually making the move and doing the downsize.
And this is really important from a financial plan standpoint. If you're relying on some of that equity or a good chunk of that equity to put groceries in your fridge, we'll talk about reverse mortgages in 1 second, but there's another idea before that is selling and signing a long-term lease agreement. How does that actually work in practice?
Yeah, it's. I think it's kind of interesting. I've seen a few people that have done this sort of thing. And basically the idea is you could consider listing your house for sale, but not for the purpose of selling it and moving into the expensive condo or moving out to the country. You could list your house for sale with the condition that you want to lease the property back. And particularly on a long-term lease, sell the house, sign a 5-year lease. You're going to limit the number of people who are going to want to buy the property because you're only going to be looking for real estate investors, but it could work out really well for the right investor who wants to have a good tenant, who's lived in the property, who's going to take care of it, who has a bunch of money because they just sold their house and is probably going to be able to make rent. So it's certainly an option to consider. You want to make sure you've got proper advice from a real estate agent and a lawyer, but I think there is certainly the opportunity to list your house for sale and offer it on a long-term lease that you'd like to immediately lease it back at the same time.
We've talked about reverse mortgages on this show a number of times. My starting point is no. My starting point is no is because they're more expensive rate-wise and there's some real admin complexity and some constraints that are very worrying to me. Make the case for yes. What are the very specific cases in which a client would come to you and you'd say, you know what? I think this makes sense for you.
Yeah. Well, look, I agree with you. My starting point with reverse mortgages is usually no, and let's look at the other alternatives. Not everybody wants to sell or downsize or sell and lease. They just want to stay in their home and keep it simple. When you are working and you've got a good income and you can afford the payments, banks love to lend money. And we've seen a lot of that recently. But when you're retired and you no longer have an income, banks are much more hesitant to lend money to people. Particularly, the optics are really bad of having to foreclose on a home and kick a senior out. So banks are much, much more hesitant to lend money to people on a mortgage or a line of credit. So I've seen cases where people have basically reached their ability to borrow money from a traditional bank, where a reverse mortgage is the option to be able to take money and take equity out of the property to stay in the property. And a lot of the traditional arguments about, oh, well, you know, reverse mortgage and you borrow the money, it reduces the amount of your inheritance or the money that you leave to your kids. Well, so does selling the property and spending the money. So both result in you reducing the amount of an estate that you leave. I think it can be a short-term option for somebody who wants to buy a little more time in their home. But again, I think it's a last-term option. You explore other options first.
What are the conversations that seniors need to be having with their kids and with their financial advisors, if they work with someone, about this downsizing question? What are the two or three critical things that need to be communicated to those two groups of people?
Good question. I'd say that as far as conversations with financial advisors, one of the things that I like to make sure people understand when they're planning for retirement and trying to figure out how they're going to cover all their expenses in retirement is trying to determine to what extent they might need to tap into home equity. And part of that is just so people can get their head around it and try to figure out, okay, if and when am I going to need to sell my home for financial reasons? And the earlier you can determine that, I think the earlier you can start to think about different plans for retirement funding. Conversations with kids are tough. I find more often than not, it's the other way around. It's the kids initiating conversations with parents. It's kids saying to mom and dad, hey, you know, you shouldn't be up there putting up Christmas lights or, you know, shoveling snow or, you know, the farm is getting to be a little too much for you, mom and dad. So a lot of times it's the other way around. And I think that children of seniors need to consider diplomatically raising these things with mom and dad to have the conversations, because there's a lot of practical reasons beyond money that somebody should consider a move.
Oh, so you're saying you shouldn't just show up on a Saturday, pack up the kitchen and take it and put it in your car? That's bad. That's not the right approach.
I'm not going to go over that well, you know?
Yeah, so, I don't think that.
And,
okay.
And I think the other challenge too is that I've experienced this firsthand personally and professionally, that the more time that goes on, the older you get, the more difficult it becomes to envision a move or a change like this. And I've seen people who've said, oh, just so much work and got to pack up and have to do these renovations. And the longer that you put it off, the harder it may get to do it in the future. So I think some of the more successful retirees I've seen downsize have been those who've done it long before they need to, and not because they have to, but because they choose to. It's a proactive approach rather than reactive.
Right.
And I tell you, when I'm working with people who are much older and smarter than me, I'm taking notes. I'm trying to figure out, how am I going to retire? How am I going to do things as I get older?
Yeah.
And certainly that's a lesson I've learned.
Jason, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Jason Heath is a certified financial planner at Objective Financial Partners. And he was here to talk to us about this whole idea of seniors downsizing. Will you or won't you? How does that affect your financial plan? Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, I'll talk to James Pirlo from Blue Peer, a company called Blue Peer, about Canada's first pension plan for doctors. And later, new research from BE Works in collaboration with the Ontario Securities Commission on protecting aging investors. For all things Moolala, you can sign up for our newsletter. It's monthly, and it just brings together a whole bunch of stuff that I've done in lots of different places. CBC Radio, BNN Bloomberg, CityLine, whatever it is. Once a month, you get a newsletter, and I promise I will never do anything with your email address.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The perception is that doctors make a lot of money. And sure, many, many do make a lot of money. But they also don't generally participate in a pension plan, making things less clear in terms of how they're going to organize their retirement savings. Blue Peer has just launched Canada's first pension plan for doctors. Joining us now to tell us what it is and how it works is James Pirlo, founder and CEO of Blue Peer. Hi there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you today?
Why was this an important thing for your company to do?
Well, most of Canada's workers don't have pensions. There's 12 million people in Canada in the workforce out of a total of 18.5 million that don't have any pension plan and never will. And that's because most of them are working for small businesses, or in the case of doctors, they're self-employed. So operating a pension plan is very complex. You have to take responsibility for asset management and record keeping and asset custody. And so those structures are by and large unavailable to self-employed professionals outside the context of a vehicle called an individual pension plan, which it's quite costly to set up and complex. So what Blue Peer is a solution. We call it a pension plan as a service. Any employer can join our plan to offer a customized workplace pension plan to themselves or to their staff if they have staff.
Why would a physician be interested in this type of investment approach versus either a traditional RRSP or setting up a corporation, driving the revenue through a corporation and paying themselves in dividends? Those two other options have been around for a very, very long period of time. They're established. They are in some ways customized to people who live at these higher income levels. Why should a more traditional pension structure be an option for them? Like, why would that be interesting?
So when you participate in a large pension arrangement, we all know that in the public sector, those plans operate very efficiently. They have good investment returns. They have low fees. So it's partly to get the advantages of economy of scale, which gives you access to institutional grade services, particularly in the area of investment management. So that's one reason. Another reason is that pension plans are much more efficient structures from a tax point of view. So the effective contribution room, the tax deductible contribution room within Blue Peer is much greater, and that results in a much larger eventual retirement income for the physician than they could get from an RSP. And the third reason is that they can actually get a retirement income, a pension income, or a variable benefit payment from the plan, whereas with an RSP, they have to convert it into some other kind of vehicle and manage it throughout retirement, which can actually get quite difficult when you get into later retirement and health is not so good. So those are some of the reasons why pension structure is better.
One of the things you write about is doctor customized features. What does that mean? Does the statement arrive with a stethoscope replacement? Is that the kind of customization that we're talking about? Green, and I don't know, masks?
What we're talking about is a structure that enables a doctor to determine from year to year how much they're going to put into their pension plan. I mean, we all know that our predictions about revenue, no matter what business we're in, and many doctors are in business, has changed as a result of COVID. And so you don't know from year to year what your revenues will be. A plan that requires you to put in a same contribution every year after year, no matter what your business revenues are, may not be a sustainable structure for doctors. So we've designed a plan that will allow doctors to determine that from a year-to-year basis based on what their ability to contribute is.
Scotiabank recently purchased a company called MD Management, which had been around for years and years and years, and it was a financial advisory practice focused on doctors. Anecdotally, a lot of the clients weren't super happy about it. Did that create an opening for you?
Well, we certainly hope so, but we didn't launch Blue Peer as a result of any other transactions in the marketplace, such as the launch of MD Management. Blue Peer has been in creation for many, many years. And this is a constituency that we have long believed is underserved in the pension market. That's not to take anything away from the existing providers, but we do believe that a real pension plan is needed for this particular constituency of the market. And to date, it just simply hasn't been available.
When you use the word pension, is it best to characterize your approach as a defined contribution pension?
That's a complex question to answer because, yes, it is structured initially as defined contribution, but whether or not it is ultimately a defined contribution or defined benefit is up to the doctor in the end. And that's part of the feature set that we offer is flexibility between defined contribution and defined benefit.
Who is eligible? Is it only physicians or could a doctor of philosophy be eligible? Could a nurse practitioner be eligible?
Blue Peer is intended to be a pension plan that serves the underserved. And so conceptually, it's open to any employer that pays an employment income, for example, a self-employed professional or a small business, et cetera. We have developed a specific feature set for self-employed professionals like doctors, and we've had a number of doctors join it. But it is open to, you know, there is a requirement that you receive employment income. That's a regulatory requirement. So it would not be open, for example, to a doctor or a self-employed professional that's not incorporated or paying in themselves an employment income or otherwise employed.
I think some of our listeners will hear the phrase underserved in the context of doctors and not have a whole heck of a lot of time for that notion, given how much they make. But the population that they'd feel a lot of heart for and empathy for are the personal support workers, particularly in this time. Is that something that could be on your product portfolio down the road?
It's not on our portfolio down the road. It's down on our portfolio in the near term. We are specifically working on that for personal support workers.
I think that could be something that will have real resonance. This doctors are notorious. They're brilliant. They went to medical school, but I wouldn't say that as a group, they necessarily engage in, this is my own personal experience. It's not data driven, but they don't really necessarily engage in personal finance during the most intense period of their career because they've got overnight call and weekend call. They've got spouses and kids and, you know, ball hockey and all these sorts of things. How do you convert them or convince them to consider a new option instead of just doing what they have always done, even if it's suboptimal?
I think it's really a communications challenge. You have to get the word out there. We're a pension plan. We're not an investment play or strategy. With Blue Peer, you don't have any investment choices. That's managed for you, just as it would be in a large pension plan of any other kind. That's essentially the service that we are offering, is an institutional pension solution. And in terms of communicating it, one way that we do that is we believe that word of mouth is going to be important. We have doctors participating in our plan. They tend to listen and pay attention to what other doctors are doing. But, you know, it's up to us to get the word out there and to communicate the value of this offering.
Maybe some, you know, illustrations of human anatomy, throw in the phrase Krebs cycle every once in a while. That'll keep them engaged. You're welcome for the advice. James, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
James Pierlow is the founder and CEO of Blue Peer. The company's focus is on a pension plan for doctors. Interesting stuff. Well, stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, are consumer proposals necessary? Are they smart? Can you get out of them? Karim Nanji is with a company called Marble Financial, and they have a new way to fast track your way out of a consumer proposal. Later, Tori from Her First 100K will be back to take our Moolala questionnaire. Now, we're hanging out on the radio, but I also spend a lot of time on TV. I am the money columnist for a show called Cityline. And if you want to check out some of those segments, you can go to cityline.tv, search for me, or better yet, take a look at some of the design features. Fashion Friday, those are interesting things.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Many Canadians consider consumer proposals to help them get rid of their debt, resolve a huge issue hanging over them. And there are pros and cons to that option, and really to all the other options people might consider. If you've agreed to a consumer proposal, there may be a Marble Financial that they say can help you get out of it faster. But should you? Karim Nanji is the CEO of Marble Financial. He joins us from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
What is Marble Financial, and have you actually lost all of your marbles?
No, sir. Marble Financial is a financial technology company. We develop software solutions and tools to help people improve and track their financial wellness, whether it be on the budgeting side or all on the credit side, because they're both very related here in Canada.
Now, the reason we're having this conversation is because you do have this product called Fast Track, and I'm interested in it. It helps people exit a consumer proposal. How does it work?
Well, for those individuals that are in a consumer proposal, you know, they've already visited a trustee and they've done, they've entered into a legally binding process with the trustee and the superintendent of bankruptcy, and they've got an agreement with the creditors to pay them over up to the 60 months. At some point in time, after the consumer proposal, individuals that have entered that process come out into the brave new world and realize that their credit score is at the lower end of the tier, which makes it very difficult for them to get any type of credit thereafter. And individuals in a consumer proposal assume that they're paying the trustee over 60 months. Their credit report is not ideal. That means most lenders will not look at them for an unsecured loan. But after you pay that trustee, assume over after 5 years, there's a record on your credit report for another 3 years. So for 8 years, individuals are in financial purgatory, and it's very difficult for them to obtain credit unless they're dealing with payday loans. and the bottom tier of the credit cycle. So Marble's Fast Track looks at qualified individuals, and they're everyday people from a normal everyday Canadian perspective. And these individuals are looking to rebuild and improve their credit. And so what Marble does is we find these qualified applicants. We do a direct pay directly to the trustee, and the individual then is paying Marble back. And what we're doing is, once we pay off the trustee, the next reporting cycle, the consumer proposal is actually discharged from your credit report.
So you're starting the clock earlier.
Yes, very much earlier. And that's actually the secret sauce right there. We start the clock earlier. And then as the consumer is paying us, we're reporting to both credit reporting agencies, TransUnion and Equifax, and the credit rebuilding starts from that point. So we see customers with no record on the credit report within 4 years versus the 8 years.
And what does it cost? So for someone who chooses that path, what does it cost them?
Okay, so on average, interest rates are around 22 to 23%. But what we do with these individuals...
Sorry, that sound was my chin slamming against my desk.
Yes, it is. It is a it's not the bank grade interest rate on this standpoint. But what we do though, Bruce, is that as the consumer is paying us, and if they're making their payments over the 2 year process, we give them up to a 4% discount retroactively. As long as their repayment history is good. So at the end of the 2 years, we will credit them back the interest payments, and we'll get it down to about 19% for these consumers.
You said qualified buyers. What does it take to qualify for your program?
Well, for the individuals, it's normal lending practices. We want to make sure the individuals are working. They have the ability to service their payments. So they're working. There is stability in their application. So the individuals need to be able to service that debt. We try to keep the payment exactly the same as what they're paying the trustee. But by what we do in that standpoint is we increase the term of the loan to keep the payment the same. What we're finding is that 60% of customers are paying us back within about 36 months. And the reason they're paying us back is because their credit score has increased to a standard that they could walk into a financial institution and get mainstream financial cost of credit.
But the program, what kind of amounts are we talking about here? Like when people are discharging the consumer proposal, is it 10 grand? Is it 50 grand?
So for those individuals that are a year into their consumer proposal, what we're finding is the average size of the loan is around 10,000. But a lot of people are 2 or 3 years into their consumer proposal. And we see a lot of those customers too. They've had 2 or 3 years of good repayment with their trustee. And these individuals, you can get the loan sizes down to $5,000, $6,000, $7,000.
Why would someone do this? Is it really that compelling to save a couple of years?
You know, going back to the question on the interest rate, we're not a bank. Our cost of capital is not the same as what banks can do. So when your chin fell on the table on the interest cost, it's lower than credit card rates. But why do people do this? Why would they pay interest to a company versus the 0% interest of paying the trustee? They're very high intent individuals who are looking to get back into mainstream economy. And they're tired of getting declined. They can't qualify for a credit card. They can't qualify for anything with respect to credit. People are getting declined for jobs because of poor credit. They're getting declined by landlords because of poor credit. And so we're finding a lot of people, remember 50%, just 47, depending on where you're getting the stats from, but 47 to 53% of Canadians are living paycheck to paycheck. And it's very challenging for these individuals. So they are very highly motivated to improve their credit and get them back into mainstream.
What support do you provide your clients to ensure that they are able to keep on top of their money in a sustainable way? And that's not to say that many of your clients probably haven't been dealt the worst possible set of cards, but there are also clients that you have who have picked up bad habits.
So what we do for individuals that have come out of an insolvency event, we're typically, because the, you know, for lenders, we look at the credit report as a guide to credit worthiness. But we know for our consumers that are interested in Fast Track, the credit report is, it's not, people are embarrassed by the credit report, so to speak. So we do not entertain that this is the right program for individuals that are coming out of a consumer proposal day one, month three. We're typically looking for individuals that have had 12 months of repayment history with their trustee. And we use that repayment history with the trustee as a proxy for creditworthiness post-insolvency, because settling your debts is just one part of the journey. People need to start developing good habits. They need to have good habits because they've reduced their debt on average, let's say it's 35 cents on the dollar. And we need to make sure that they've got good habits. But Marble, and if individuals want to go to mymarble.ca, there's a lot of free financial literacy and education information to help individuals. We also have software that can help individuals using data-driven information from their bank accounts, from their credit reports, to help guide them on the right decisions to make with respect to how they're handling their finances.
Well, Krim, thank you for joining us today. It's an interesting product. The pro and the con on the math would be something that would be so important for individuals to figure out. But I appreciate you taking the time to explain to us about Fast Track.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Krim Nanji is the CEO of Marble Financial. They have a program called Fast Track where you can actually exit a consumer proposal early, but at a cost. As I said, those interest rates were a bit of a shocker to me. Stay with us. Coming up next, new research from BE Works in collaboration with the Ontario Securities Commission about how you can reduce fraud against seniors. Then we'll take Tori from her first 100K through our Moolala questionnaire. If you'd like some more of the Moolala podcast, you can download full episodes of the show on whatever platform you listen to your podcasts on, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, whatever. You can also go to moolala.ca, and there you'll be able to search for topics and individual segments and you know, guests, whatever. While you're at any of those platforms, please feel free to subscribe, write us a review. We love hearing from you.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
All investors are vulnerable to financial fraud or abuse, but this is especially true for seniors. Sometimes the very basic steps that can act as a circuit breaker or protection get missed. For example, there is something called the trusted contact person. And that's information that can be really important to protect older investors, but it is a step that can get missed on financial forms. BE Works, in collaboration with the Ontario Securities Commission, has released some new research that identifies how the industry can use behavioral insights to protect older Canadians. Joining me now is Tyler Fleming, Director of the Investor Office at the OSC. Hello, Tyler.
Hi, Bruce.
What are some examples of financial fraud that is more often focused on Canadians 65 years and older?
You know what? There's all sorts of different frauds. I wouldn't actually want to name just one. The reality is that people can be taken advantage of by family, by friends, by any number of people, and in many different ways. But I think the important thing to remember is that it can happen to anybody. Anyone can become a victim of fraud or financial exploitation. The fraudsters are very good at manipulating and getting at people and their money. And so it can happen to everyone. And so one of the ways that we are trying to help protect people, not just from financial exploitation, but also in cases where, you know, getting older, many people over time might have experienced changes in their brains, and that is a normal process of human aging, but sometimes that can affect our decision making. So as you mentioned, we have been working with our colleagues across Canada on a policy project which, among other things, seeks to establish a requirement that the industry, that advisors, make reasonable efforts to obtain what's called a trusted contact person. A trusted contact person, you know, it's someone that your advisor could call if they suspect that you're maybe being financially abused or there's other warning signs there. It's kind of like if you think of an emergency contact you give your kid's school, it's someone that can be contacted, just say, hey, you know, what's up with Bruce? I just know he normally he's in
every month. Little off today. No, people think of that of me all the time. He's a little off today. And we don't have enough people listed to possibly hem in my behavior. I want to ask how that process goes. How does one set up a trusted contact person? And is it on everyone's account, or is it really something that's focused on people who are at the older end of the age spectrum?
Yeah, so it's a pretty new concept. So there's different ways of collecting it. In the US, they've been doing this a little bit longer than we will have. And what we know is that the majority of ways that this information is collected is through a form. Advisors will be talking to their clients as well, having these conversations. But generally, there'll be some standard form that a firm will provide that can be used in these conversations. Design of forms, that gets at the heart of this study, because we know that small changes to forms can actually nudge people to make better or different decisions. And there's a lot of defaults and assumptions built into the way forms are designed that might seem neutral to people who don't put a ton of thought into it, but actually can have real impacts on the choices people make. So this project, Bruce, the one that we've just published, we set out to identify ways of designing a form that would collect the trusted contact person information that would increase the likelihood that people would provide this information. We're not proposing that every person have to give it. It's just that the advisor or the dealer makes reasonable efforts to obtain it.
The thought of talking about filling out a form is quite possibly the most boring notion I have ever heard of in my entire career, on the one hand. On the other hand, because it is couched in the wisdom of behavioral insights, it's fascinating because, mm-hmm. as you say, small changes can have an enormous impact on results. So give us some examples of what sort of structural changes could be made to increase the probability of not only a financial advisor asking for that particular name and phone number, but the client being willing to and saying yes and getting that name on the file.
For sure. And I know it does sound boring, which is why a lot of people don't give a lot of thought to how these are designed. And we really wanted to show how it can make a difference. So there's a few behavioral concepts I'll mention first that played into this study. People tend to underestimate the likelihood of something bad happening to them. This could be underweighting the risks of suffering from financial exploitation or cognitive impairment. People also don't like to think about negative situations or scenarios that create unpleasant feelings. So again, they might not want to just think about a case where they will be taken advantage of. And then also people tend to overestimate their abilities and their qualities in relation to the same qualities of other people. So other people will become a victim of fraud. Other people will make poor decisions, but I won't. Those are some common human behavioral concepts that we needed to take into account here. So with these forms, basically what we did is we tried to address that. So through things such as priming people's decisions by triggering certain mindsets, debiasing people in terms of how frequent fraud occurs. There's the concept of social norming. This influences our decision-making in terms of what people around us or what we think the group or the herd is doing. In this case, what we did is we used survey data to show that 90% of Canadians actually support the idea of a TCP. So
everybody's doing it. What do you mean you don't have a trusted contact person? What are you, an animal? Everybody has one. All the cool kids have one.
That's kind of what it's getting at, because in the absence of that information, people revert to their status quo or the status quo bias, where their status quo or their bias is to not have a TCP. So this is a novel decision they're being asked to make, and people find it helpful to understand what people around them are doing.
There is so much paperwork when one opens an account. So I can imagine that's easier because it just becomes yet another thing. You fill it on yet another form. What seems to be more challenging is when you've got an established relationship with an advisor. You've been with them for decades and I have to sign something new. What is the process by which those people are going to put that information on their file? Because some of them just don't have a highly engaged relationship with their advisor. And in today's pandemic era, they're not wandering by the office to sign a set of forms.
This is true, but advisors are required to know their client, and that means knowing significant changes in their life, their personal financial circumstances. So conversations are supposed to have to occur from time to time. There is supposed to be methods of obtaining this information. So you know, we recognize that it's not just about presenting a form. These are conversations that advisors need to have or clients raise with their advisor. So there's other work underway in terms of helping with discussion guides and other tools, but there's a lot of different ways to facilitate this information. It is new for people. It's a new concept. And so we're really trying to increase the uptake because we know it can make a difference. The forms, the key finding with this, we proposed a version of the form using some of these techniques that resulted in a significant 23% increase in the uptake. So that is a massive finding, Bruce. That means many, many more people using this version of the form, if this were used in the real world, could potentially sign up for a trusted contact person. And that's a big difference, right? And that will help people prevent fraud. It will help them avoiding losses, and it will help protect their money. And so we're really working with the industry now to help publicize these findings and help
you
them.
You didn't even acknowledge my snore there. It was a very well-placed snore. I'm afraid, Tyler, that's all the time we have. I snore, okay, but completely in jest, because I think it's very important that people know what trusted contact person is as an idea, and for advisors that they get moving on getting that onto people's records, and for investors that they add that information because it is in service of them and the safety of their accounts. Tyler, thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much, Bruce. Appreciate it.
Tyler Fleming, director of the investor office at the OSC. He's probably just rolling his eyes saying, I can't believe I got snored at by Bruce Selry. Ridiculous. Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. Of course, this is our series of questions. Most of them never change from show to show, but what always changes is the respondent. And today our respondent is Tori Dunlap. She is the author, the founder, the person behind her first 100K. And Tori, are you ready for question number one?
I'm ready. I purposely did not look at what these questions are so I can come to them fresh. So I'm excited.
Very smart. Very smart. How would you describe your money personality?
I'm a financial feminist.
And what does it mean to be a financial feminist?
It means that we fight the patriarchy through financial education. We always consider not just the how, but you know, how we got here as well. So talking about the issues around how do you budget, but also how do you have to budget differently knowing your background or knowing who you are.
If we were to play the biopic of your life, where would that personality have been set? What would the catalyst have been? You might not have had the language for it as a 7-year-old or a 12-year-old, but what was the moment when we look back at that narrative and say, oh, it was then. That was the moment in which I became a financial feminist.
I was 12 and my dad, shout out to dad, I think he's listening. He always was the coach of our softball team. And that year on a all girls softball team and we won the league and it made a lot of people angry. Our last game was a co-ed team, but mostly boys and then all men coaches. And they were not happy that this all girl team who had, you know, pink uniforms and had, you know, spray painted our bat pink. They did not like that we had won. And I remember very clearly, like, that was my first experience with like blatant sexism. And thinking about it now, I was like, oh, that changed how I perceived the world.
Wow. I love it. I love it. What is your favorite thing to spend money on? You and I share a core value that people should get a handle on their money, not because, it'll make their mom happier because they're going to go to heaven, but because then they get to choose the life that they want. For you, right. What do you love to spend on?
Yeah. Travel is my big thing. And with COVID kind of putting a wrench in that, I've tried to do like little staycations or road trips. I go on what I call a friend moon with my best friend every year. We take a honeymoon as best friends. So Last year was a road trip through Italy. That was like once in a lifetime, one of my, like the best 10 days of my life. And this year was supposed to be Australia and New Zealand. And for obvious reasons, we couldn't go. So we actually did a 10-day road trip through national parks. So we went to Glacier National Park and Yellowstone, and did about 45 hours in the car with each other from Seattle to all of these different places. And that has been such an eye-opening experience and a really cool thing to do with my best friend, who is my favorite person in the world.
I had a speaking gig in Maui in February, and I took my best friend to Hawaii. And, you know, as soon as we got home, the world changed, but we had one final BFF event in Hawaii. Spectacular.
That's amazing.
What is your, one of your favorite personal finance influences? It could be a book, it could be a blog, it could be a columnist. What is one of your touchstones?
I mean, there's so many women in this industry who I look up to and continue to look up to, but now they're my friends and colleagues.
Yeah.
So there were so many, you know, personal finance blogs and YouTube channels and books that I read when I'm starting my journey, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And it's so cool now to be able to, you know, have these people on speed dial. So, I mean, a short list: Stephanie O'Connell, Erin Lowry from Broke Millennial, the team over at the Financial Diet, Tiffany from the Budgetista. There's so many different, you know, different platforms now of women and women of color and LGBTQ women who are talking about money. And it's so cool to be able to look up to these people and now call them friends. So that's been one of the coolest parts of it.
Oh, it's great. If there was one topic that you wish you never, ever, ever had to talk about or write about again, what would it be? And what is another that you could literally wake up at 7 a.m. and do a webinar and a speech and a coaching conversation and be like, oh my God, I'm talking about this all day, every day. So the one for always and the one for never.
The funny thing is the answer's the same for both. Because, and I'll tell you why, the first one I don't want to have to ever talk about again is the need to talk about these conversations in a different way if you're a woman. Right. Like, you just, again, have to have a different conversation. And there's been so much feedback I've gotten from a lot of men who say, like, why can't she just leave the feminism out of it? Why can't she just talk about money? Why does this have to be a woman's issue? And for me, it's so obvious that it has to be a woman's issue. And that's why I could talk about it all day long. But my hope is that someday it just feels so obvious that I don't have to convince people, that I don't have to have a conversation about why we have to talk about money differently if you're a person of color or if you're a woman.
So you're okay to make one of your core messages redundant. You're okay to make a core message redundant. Like, happily, fine. Yeah. Okay, one last question here. If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, and I don't mean systemic, I mean from an individual perspective, what would that behavior be?
The fear of investing. The number one reason women don't invest is fear. Fear of doing it incorrectly, fear of doing it wrong, the fear that they'll somehow lose all of their money. And it's one of the biggest ways, of course, to grow wealth and to have real financial power and real financial stability. And so I would take away the fear of investing and give every single person, especially women out there, the tools and the education to know how to invest and to invest confidently.
Done. I will uninvent the fear of investing by Tuesday. You're welcome. You can thank me later.
Perfect. I'll make a calendar invite.
Perfect. That's great. Tori Dunlap, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tori is with, or the person behind, her first 100K. Check it out. So much great insight. So sassy and so fun, as you heard in our conversation. That is our show for today. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, then subscribe to our newsletter. You can do that at moolala.ca. Also, we would so love it if you subscribe to the podcast version of this SiriusXM radio show. And while you're there, leave us a review. If you have comments or thoughts or ideas or questions, the email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. I am a reluctant participant in social media, but I am on Twitter @BruceSelry, Facebook, Bruce Selry Moolala. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.